from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we focus our attention in this next hour on Iran, its past, present, and future. Protests have once again flared up, and Stanford Iranian Studies Program Director Abbas Milani joins us in studio for the hour to talk about what these new acts of rebellion may bode. We'll also find out about his new biography of the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who sat on the peacock throne ruling Iran until the Khomeini Revolution ended that 37-year rule. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Recent events in Iran have once again raised questions about grassroots activism and the possibility of a popular uprising against the present regime. The last uprising, after an election deemed to be dishonest and illegitimate by many Iranians, ended in a brutal and repressive crackdown on the mostly youthful protesters. One of the most important voices on Iran in the United States has been Iranian-born Abbas Milani, who has appeared frequently with us on Forum and who directs the Iranian Studies Program at Stanford and the Iran Democracy Project at the Hoover Institution, where he is a research fellow. Author of Persian Sphinx and Eminent Persians, he recently published a biography of the Shah of Iran, who ruled Iran on the peacock throne for 37 years until 1979, when he went into exile following a popular revolution that ushered in the present theocracy. Abbas Milani joins us in studio, and good to see you and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you. Well, let's begin with what's going on now. We were talking before we went on air about something that Mousavi and the opposition put out on the internet, which I think bears repeating because, first of all, it's funny and it goes right to the quick of sentiments that many of us have about what's going on in Iran today.
They put two pictures, one of Egyptian security forces beating on peaceful demonstrators, another one, image of regime thugs and IRGC, Revolutionary Guards, beating on peaceful demonstrators in Iran. And underneath the caption said, one of them is God's soldier doing God's work, the other one is a lackey of imperialism and Zionism doing the work of the great Satan.
Well, that kind of says a lot. But meanwhile, Mousavi is under house arrest. There's talk about the opposition, not only Mousavi, but the former Speaker of the Parliament being put on trial with the possibility of execution. And this is a regime that simply brooks no quarter.
It really doesn't. And the fact that they feel like they can do anything they want, they don't need to be responsive to the international community. They're not, like Egypt, hopeful to gain foreign aid from the United States. So they have gone on a rampage in the last 24 hours. They have arrested hundreds of demonstrators. One has been killed. A dozen have been injured. And remarkably, after a completely peaceful demonstration, and by law, constitutionally, a lawful demonstration, because the Iranian law, Articles 27, says if you're having a peaceful demonstration, you don't even need the government permission. The members of the parliament have issued a statement, 220 of them, demanding that Mousavi, Karroubi, and Khatami, who actually had nothing to do with this, be put on trial and executed.
Yeah, it's astonishing, especially in light of the fact that what's played out in Egypt has been kind of a bully pulpit for Ahmadinejad and others in control of the theocracy to say, isn't this great for the Islamic world and so forth, when they're just beating heads and putting people on trial.
Well, from the moment they began talking about Egypt, I knew that lady doth protest too much. I knew they were frightened out of their bejesus because they knew this has nothing to do. Egypt has nothing to do with Iran 79. Egypt has a lot to do with Iran 2009. It is a lot to do with the new wind of change, essentially spearheaded by the youth, which is disproportionately large part of Iran and large part of the Middle East. They are not going to be ruled by medieval despots and by kleptomaniac authoritarian regimes.
Well, President Obama spoke about Iran in the recent protests at his news conference today. Let's just hear some of this.
I find it ironic that you've got
the Iranian regime pretending to celebrate what happened in Egypt, when in fact they have acted in direct contrast to what happened in Egypt by gunning down and beating people who were trying to express themselves peacefully in Iran.
Well, as you well know, Professor Milani, the president has been criticized in this administration for not acting strongly enough or speaking strongly enough when the last protests came out after that farce of an election, as it was described by many. It's pretty clear now that the U.S. administration is trying to use stronger rhetoric. Secretary of State Clinton said Iranians deserve the same rights as were played out in Egypt. Iran must open up its political system. The U.S. very clearly and decidedly supports the protesters.
I think you're absolutely right. They're trying to make up for the few steps that they missed, the few beats that they missed, I think. They were late in coming to the support of the Green Movement. Not that, to be fair to them, not that they might have necessarily changed the outcome, but I think it would have gone a long way in consolidating Mr. Obama's popularity in Iran at the time. He lost a considerable portion of it when he did fail to come out strongly and unambiguously in support of the movement in its early days.
One could look back, and we're doing a lot of it these days because of what happened in Egypt at the Iranian Revolution, which, of course, you write about in your book about the Shah, in your biography about the Shah. There was an opportunity in Iran at that time. Leftists, trade unionists, many who were protesting, who seemed to really want considerable change and not a theocracy. And then there was that kind of vacuum, and it was filled up by the organized clergy and mullahs who were behind Khomeini. Couldn't the same thing happen in Egypt?
Unfortunately, I think it could, in the sense that the Muslim Brotherhood, although it professes to have parted with its past radical rhetoric, with its past attempt to use bullet and pressure to establish a government of theocracy, they now say that they are a democratic government willing to work within the constitution. But unfortunately,
not fielding a candidate, nonviolent.
Absolutely. But if you go back to what Ayatollah Khomeini said in the month before the revolution, the rhetoric is eerily reminiscent of what we are now hearing from the Muslim Brotherhood. What makes me particularly worried is that the Muslim Brotherhood leaders then go on BBC Persian and speak a different language when they think they're speaking to the people of Iran. On BBC Persian, they said, one of the leaders said, a government similar to Iran, a president similar to Ahmadinejad, is our dream in Egypt. Well, that to me is very different than saying to the Egyptian people that we want a law-abiding government. There's nothing law-abiding about Ahmadinejad in Iran. There's nothing democratic about the Iranian regime. This leader actually called Khamenei Imam, something that even Khamenei's most stalwart supporters in Iran don't dare do. So Muslim Brotherhood speaks with two languages, even today. And that gives me considerable concern. But hopefully the Egyptian Democrats have learned the lesson that the Iranian Democrats were late in listening. That is, be careful who your allies are. Be careful you have a clear set of plans for how you're going to transition to a new government. And don't be fooled by rhetoric on the eve of change. Look at these people's records in their historical context and then decide whether they're reliable allies.
Of course, historically and culturally, we're talking about, well, a pretty quantum difference between Shiite and Sunni.
Well, absolutely. The Sunni faith does not have a clerical class. They don't believe in the existence of someone like an Ayatollah. But, you know, there is some striking affinities. Khamenei has translated three of Sayyid Qutb's books into Persian. Sayyid Qutb is the ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood. Although he is Sunni and he is Shiite, Khamenei is Shiite, there is enough of affinity because both of them were talking about the need to create a government based on Sharia. And I think if Muslim Brotherhood wants to be a democratic participant, they have to say that we are going to be playing by not the rules of Sharia, but by the rules of a democratic polity, by social contract drawn by every Egyptian, Muslim, Jewish, Coptic, non-believers, all of them. If you accept that, then you can be a democratic player. If you say, we're going to play by Sharia, in which woman's life is worth half of the life of a man. I mean, this is literally what Sharia demands. That's not a democratic beginning.
Our guest is Professor Abbas Milani, and his book is The Shah. It's called The Shah. It's a biography of the Shah of Iran. The fall of the Shah was really, for you, a pivotal event, and you say that the pathologies of his rule really begat, I think I'm quoting you directly here, the Islamic Revolution, and we have the Shah to blame?
I think partly, absolutely, because the Shah, although he made profound changes in Iran, he did take
He modernized it, really.
Absolutely. He modernized. He ended feudalism in Iran. He created a large middle class, but he virtually destroyed the moderate middle in Iranian politics. He obviously went after the communists. This was the Cold War. But he also went after the moderate secular Democrats. The only political institution in Iran during the Shah that had the chance, in fact, was encouraged by the Shah to mobilize and organize and create an institution in every neighborhood were the clergy. And when the system went into crisis, as it did in 78, the only national institution capable of holding the country together by the Americans deemed to be, by the British, was deemed to be the clergy. And the clergy, led by Khomeini, were saying all the right things, including to the Americans. I mean, I've discovered some remarkable documents about how eager Khomeini was to contact the Americans and tell them, look, I'm going to create a democratic polity. What do you want? Do you want oil? You want me to stop communists? And we want...
How soon was it after that that we were being called the Great Satan?
Literally within a month.
I mean, some of these classified documents that you've had access to are really extraordinarily revealing. I mean, what you just alluded to. But also, I think I want to find out some more about them, because one of the most shocking things is there's always been this assumption that the Shah was our buddy, so he wasn't necessarily moving Iran toward nuclear capabilities. But the same things were going on, we discover, under the Shah that are going on under this regime with respect to trying to be nuclear empowered.
No, absolutely. I think you're exactly right. One of the myths propagated by this clerical regime, and a myth, incidentally, that was not challenged by the United States for a reason that I never understood. It's the myth that the United States was basically willing to give the Shah everything he wanted, and now that the Islamic regime is in power, they're not giving him. The Carter administration, the Ford administration, for 3.5 years basically did not allow an American company to invest in Iran because they began to suspect that the Shah was going potentially for a nuclear bomb. The minute they found that out, Ford and Carter administration put a complete stop, and many of the issues that are now at the forefront of the impasse between Iran and the United States, Iran and the international community, were at the background in the diplomatic halls, not in the public domain, subject of fierce confrontation between U.S. and the Shah. And to his credit, I must say, the Shah was standing firm on what he thought Iran's rights were within the MPT.
Which is essentially the argument you're hearing from the mullahs now, isn't it?
With one big difference. The mullahs are making the same argument, but the mullahs have lied to IAEA. They have cheated in the IAEA. And the IAEA, the bylaws of the MPT are very clear. If you lie and cheat, you lose your inalienable right. The NPT calls enrichment an inalienable national right. You lose it only if you lie and cheat. And this regime has clearly lied, is clearly cheated. It started a center to have 50,000 centrifuges underground, 25 feet underground. The center is large enough to contain 3 soccer or football fields. They build it 25 feet underground without telling the IAEA. When you lie and cheat, you lose your rights within MPT.
When we're speaking about the IAEA, it makes me wonder if Khomeini was a likely successor to the Shah because he was such an iconic figure. Does El-Baradei have that kind of, well, gravitas, or does he have that kind of love of the Egyptian people, really, in any degree?
It doesn't seem to me. I don't know enough about his popularity, but the little that I have seen, he simply doesn't have it. And he doesn't have the kind of a forceful...
Charisma.
Charisma. Yeah. And the willingness to pay any price to get his goals achieved. Ayatollah Khomeini was remarkable. The only person that comes to mind, in my view, in 20th century is Lenin and Stalin, who had kind of monomaniacal decision on what they wanted to do and were willing to pay any price to do it. Ayatollah Khomeini sent thousands of people to their sure death walking over minefields because he thought this is God's work. Didn't bat an eye.
That certainty, in some ways, even though you present a multidimensional view of the Shah of Iran, a man who was had ubiquitous sycophants and was constantly being adored and, well, had power corrupt him, the same ways in many respects as it's done to Mubarak. Nevertheless, he was also certain that he had done so much for his people and that they couldn't possibly be against him. He was also certain of his rule, that his rule came from God, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And more than once he said that the reason the Americans don't understand my contact with the people, the reason, you know, the Americans, again, behind the scenes, with the exception of the Nixon administration.
He and Nixon were pretty close, actually.
Very close. Yeah. Yeah. But with the exception of the Nixon administration, every U.S. administration, Truman, everybody, was behind the scenes pressuring the Shah to democratize. They were telling him that if you go on this path, you're going to fall. And his often repeated answer was that you don't understand the contact, the deep ties that bind me with the people of Iran. This is a mystical national thing in our psyche. And he was surprised. And one of the diplomats says when he saw 1.5 million people demonstrate against him, he was like a jilted lover. He felt completely betrayed by the woman.
I suspect that's how Mubarak felt, don't you?
Oh, clearly. Yeah. From some of the interviews, I saw the text of an interview he did, a discussion he did with an Israeli official. The Israeli member of Knesset. And basically he said, after all I've done for these people, I've given them 60 years of service and they have mistreated me this way. And he was more or less angry at them and felt like a jilted lover. They don't remember that if you're a lover, you're not supposed to pick the pocket of your beloved, as these people pick the pocket of the people of Egypt and, to some extent, Iran.
Our guest again is Abbas Milani, and his book is The Shah. There really is a sense of the Shah that, in the way you portray them, as being megalomaniacal on the one hand, but really weak and vacillating and paranoid. And I mean, it's a fully dimensional portrait in many ways. What I was surprised in finding, especially in the portrait you give of him, his sort of ego ideal was de Gaulle.
He looked at de Gaulle as the ultimate, and for several reasons. The Shah was very much a Francophile. He loved the French culture. He spoke French fluently. He was trained in Swiss school. He was very impressed with height. The Shah had a thing about height. And tall people, tall women, for example, were very much on his mind. And de Gaulle was taller. His father was taller. He talks about his father's height in a really remarkable way.
I didn't know his father was a Cossack soldier either. I mean, you learn these kind of facts that are really fascinating. Although his father, he could have learned a lesson from his father, because when his father left, the United States didn't exactly grant him embracing. And the same thing happened with the Shah. And he goes to Egypt, and he gets a royal welcome, and then he goes to Morocco and expects that kind of welcome. Not there.
Morocco at least gives him a few weeks. Jordan, the king of Jordan, who had enjoyed the Shah's hospitality, who had received millions of dollars of grants from the Shah, wouldn't even allow his plane to land in Jordan. Every country, remarkably, with the exception of Sadat, turned his back towards the Shah. It is truly, when you look at the way he was treated, I mean, the Shah was not worse than Idi Amin. He wasn't worse than any of these other people who were given a safe harbor to die and live in exile. Mubarak is getting it. The Tunisian despot is getting it. But for the Shah, there seemed to be an international euphoria for the regime, forgiving every sin of the regime, and bringing all the pressure, incredible pressure. the Iranian regime announces officially that they have taken a contract with Carlos to kill the Shah, and nobody calls them for it. Nobody says, what the hell are you doing? A legal government can't put a contract on a citizen in another country with a terrorist like Carlos. No,
Khomeini did it with a fatwa against Rushdie. And somehow this has been, I can't help but remember, of course, the American embassy being taken over in that aftermath of a monarchy, as you point out, 2,500 years in existence, and the sovereignty of the United States simply trampled all over. I mean, because an embassy is the sovereignty of a country.
And they got away with it. They literally got away with it. And the lesson they took, we know this from many memoirs now published, we know this from some documents, the lesson Khomeini took was that Americans are weak and they're puppets, and if you stand firm to them, they will back down. They're not willing to take a hit.
Just what bin Laden thought after Somalia, right?
Exactly.
Savak, the secret intelligence of the Shah of Iran, hasn't changed that much in terms of the way it operates under the present regime, has it?
It has
a different name, but it's pretty...
It has a different name, but to be, you know, I was a prisoner of Savak, but to be fair to them, compared to this regime, they were Sunday school teachers. Although they used torture, but the nature of the torture, the extent of it, the number of people killed by this regime compared to that regime is just a different ballpark. In the entire 37 year of the Shah, the number of people executed for political crimes is less than 1,500. This regime killed almost 4,000 of the Mujahideen within a 2-3 week period. These were people who were serving time on another earlier offense in prison, and their only crime was that they were deemed in courts that sometimes lasted literally 2-3 minutes. They were deemed to be still opponents of the regime. Khomeini issued an order. These groups of three, the Committee of Three, would come into prisons. We have detailed accounts of this. Harvard law student has written a doctoral dissertation about it. It really brought tears to my eyes when I was reading it. They bring this young 15-year-old, 16-year-old girl, for example, that they have arrested for distributing a paper. They ask two or three questions. And if they think that this student is still opposed to the Shah, to the Khomeini regime, they execute him. They executed about 4,000 of these people. Compared to the Shah's regime, this is absolutely a different ballpark.
What do you say to... Let me give out the phone number. We'll come back with Professor Milani, but we also come to your calls and your responses. If you have some questions or comments, we welcome them. And in fact, you can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your calls. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address is simply forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We'll continue talking about the ongoing protests going on in Iran and also about the Shah of Iran, tome of a biography that Abbas Milani has put out, and a very important definitive biography of the Shah of Iran. Hope you'll join us. Please feel free to do that. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Abbas Milani. His new book is The Shah, and it's a book that essentially tells the story of the Shah of Iran and his rise and fall, his family, and we're still talking about the aftermath. In fact, before I go to your calls and emails, I was going to ask Abbas Milani about the argument that one hears, particularly from the left, that we wouldn't have had the Shah if it hadn't been for the United States overthrowing the regime before with CIA help, and that regime was replaced by the Khomeini regime. In other words, it all goes back to the United States. It all really is the United States as this hegemonic power and CIA influence and so forth that has created essentially what we see today.
You know, I think this is a profoundly Manichaean view. It is the result of the Cold War. It is, I think, simple even simple-minded. The United States' relationship with Iran was far more complicated than simply the United States propping up a dictator. That I have tried to show that, as I indicated earlier, that without fail, with only the Nixon administration as an exception, behind the scenes, the United States was trying to temper the Shah's appetite for military, was trying to convince him to open up the political system. During the Kennedy administration, they literally forced him to open up the political system to make profound changes. So to simply reduce it to that and simply say that the Shah was a creation of the United States, I think allows our thinking to fall prey to the Cold War rhetoric. And the Islamic Republic has been extremely clever to take that Cold War rhetoric, simply use some of the terminology. Instead of imperialism, they now talk about istikbar. Instead of the proletariat, they talk about mustazafin. But the structure of that simple-minded Manichaean view is the same. The great Satan is responsible for all that happened in the world, and the Iranian people had no responsibility in what happened to the Shah.
Doesn't the Central Intelligence Agency, though, bear, from what we know now of history, a great deal of responsibility for overturning the regime before the Shah and putting the Shah into power?
The Central Intelligence Agency certainly bears responsibility, some responsibility. But as I have pointed in the book, what changed Mossadegh's fate? You're referring to 1953,
yes,
when the government of Mossadegh was overthrown. But in my view, and I think there is much evidence, what really weakened Mossadegh and made him vulnerable politically was the fact that the clergy decided to go against them and sided with the Shah. So if there is one force that is responsible domestically for the fall of Mossadegh, it is the clergy. Ayatollah Kashani, the leader of the religious forces then, Ayatollah Burujerdi, another very prominent leader, both by 1953 were clearly siding with the Shah, clearly working against Mossadegh. It was Kashani that brought out his forces in February to stop the Shah from leaving the country. Kashani brought out his forces in August 17 and 18 to fight pro-Mossadegh forces. So it is a complicated picture. And of course, Mossadegh made a tactical, I think, error in dismissing the parliament. Once he dismissed the parliament, the Shah felt that he had the constitutional right to dismiss him. And that's what happened in August 53. The Shah used that technicality to make what is called a recess appointment and tried to dismiss the Shah. But the CIA and the British intelligence had been very much working from 51. The British intelligence from 51, the U.S. essentially from November 52 to overthrow Mossadegh.
Let's bring our callers on, and Ramin is first up here. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's such an honor to be able to have this program. My question is that during the last revolt in Iran, and I'm an Iranian expat, by the way, we saw that during the 2009 revolt that the regime was showed all its capability to crack down using the Basiji shock troops, and that was much more than, for instance, in the Egyptian case. So therefore, the learning curve of the Iranian movement is going to be different than that of Egypt. My concern is that if we want this the Iranian revolt to succeed, and knowing that the SCGs are going to be much harsher in responding to them, would it be legitimate from people from the outside, you know, the expat community worldwide, to help the ordinary movement physically actually be able to resist these people with various means, perhaps covertly, whatnot?
I think it's not only right for the Iranian diaspora to help the people of Iran, I think it is our responsibility. Iran has a very powerful diaspora. There are over 3 million in the United States. It is an economically remarkably successful diaspora. It is a very educated diaspora, and I think we have the capacity and the responsibility to offer any help we can. The regime obviously is going to blame it all on the CIA. The regime is going to blame it on the great Satan. But we have to just take that as a granted that that is what they will do. There is much we can do. There is much the diaspora can do. To just give you one example, the regime uses draconian censorship. They just put about 40 writers on a blacklist saying that they cannot publish works in Iran. Well, the Iranian diaspora has both the technological capacity and it has the financial capacity to set up a fund outside, set up a site outside, and say anybody whose work is banned in Iran, we will buy the rights for that book and put it on the internet for free and allow people to download it. That is going to break the back of the censorship in Iran. We can do it. We should do it. And I can't believe why we haven't done this kind of a thing far more actively than we have so far.
And let me thank the caller. We've had a failure of intelligence, certainly, as you point out, when the Shah was overthrown. We had a failure of intelligence in Egypt. Nobody would have expected what happened in Egypt. Nobody really anticipated it until Tunisia occurred. And so what does this tell us about what we need to know more about what's going on in Iran, particularly now that it's even more isolated?
I think what it shows is that exactly as you indicate and imply in your question, we need to know more about this this country. One of the most remarkable things about Iran is that from 30 years ago, it has been clear that it is one of the challenges of the United States. Almost every administration has said this is the biggest challenge we face. Condi Rice said before Congress, Iran is the biggest challenge. But compare it to Soviet Union. When Soviet Union was the threat, there were millions of dollars available at universities to study Iran. There were programs to teach Persian language, teach Persian culture. The number of centers studying Iran diminished after the revolution. Remarkable. And it began to increase only after September 11th, and it began to increase essentially because of the Iranian diaspora. Stanford has an Iranian studies program. I'm at Stanford simply because the Moghaddam family had the vision and the financial capacity to support it. A lady called Bita Daryabari came forward and endowed our capacity to bring in Iranian artists. Right now, we have one of Iran's best filmmakers teaching a class on theater and films in Iran, Bahram Beizai. And instead, the U.S. government should have been funding, the foundation should have been funding dozens of centers like this to study Iran, to study the language, to study the culture, and not make the kind of intelligence mistake that, as you said, has bedeviled U.S. policy in Egypt and Iran.
And we go to more of our calls, and we'll welcome Sarah. Good morning.
Good morning. Love your show, and I'm a fan of Dr. Milani. I'm an Iranian, and I left Iran 10 years ago at age 19. I have a master's degree, and I want to tell them, please do not listen to the Islamic Brotherhood and the clergy. Do whatever you can not to listen to people. Just look at Iran's example. I lost family members. I have family all over the world. I have friends lost.
Sarah, your phone line is not working that well, I'm sorry to say. Maybe we can get a better connection with you, and I'll put you on hold here. Let me go to another caller in the meantime. And the next caller is Mehdi. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to ask Mr. Milani a question. All the polls that have been done before election and after election, the proofs that Ahmadinejad won, American universities, University of Tehran, everywhere, I want to know his opinion.
Well, I don't know what polls you're talking about. If you're talking about a poll, allow me to answer. If you're talking about the University of Maryland poll or the recent poll that was done a few weeks ago where they called 702 people from Turkey and ask them what their opinion was and ask them whether they voted for Ahmadinejad, that is a sham. That is not a poll. If somebody had done this as an undergraduate honors thesis at Stanford, we would have flunked them. To think that you can call somebody in Iran, where everybody knows every phone call is monitored by the regime, and say, I'm calling from Turkey. I want to ask your opinion about the most sensitive national issue questions. What do you think about Iran's nuclear program? And if you think they are going to tell you the truth, I have a couple of bridges here I want to send you. Contact me at Stanford, and we can negotiate on the price. People voted with their feet. Out of a population of 12 million, 3 million people, braved thugs and armed police and came out and said, what happened to my vote? For every poll that you indicate, there are dozens of other polls and studies that show that the election was stolen, that Ahmadinejad did not win, and that what they decided to do is organize an electoral coup because they didn't want to face the possibility of a Mousavi victory.
Is Ahmadinejad really the power in Iran? I mean, I keep hearing, and I think you've said on this program before, it's really the mullahs who are pulling his strings. And therefore, you say about the Shah in your book, he didn't rule so much as, it was a ruling as opposed to a reign. He ruled Iran. The mullahs are ruling Iran, are they not?
Well, I think they're certainly trying. But now I think Khamenei is increasingly dependent on the IRGC and these gangs, the Basij, who are actually doing the beating.
Yeah, Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
Iranian Revolutionary Guards and this. The case of Ahmadinejad is fascinating, I think, because although there is, again, overwhelming evidence that Ahmadinejad was elected the first time because Khamenei put his support behind them and ordered the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, and the Basij to vote for him. From the minute he came to power, he began to put in his own allies. He has a very extensive network amongst the commanders of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards. Some of his closest friends are people who were founders of the Quds Brigade, the part of the Revolutionary Guards that do all the terrorist activities outside, who organized Hezbollah in Lebanon. So
you're suggesting there may be some division there that is maybe perhaps even invisible to us. I remember, wasn't it Khomeini's, not his father-in-law, but his son's father who had said some things that were favorable about Israel and he wanted to put him in his administration and the mullahs said no and there was real conflict over that. Yeah.
Absolutely. You're referring to a gentleman by the name of Mashai, who is Ahmadinejad's father-in-law. Khomeini literally ordered Ahmadinejad to fire this guy. Ahmadinejad wrote a letter saying that because you have the constitutional right to tell me that, I will fire him, and then turned around and gave him another job, more important. The guy now has 14 jobs. Mashai is virtually the second man in the Iranian government.
Nothing like nepotism in Iran.
Oh, Ahmadinejad came to, by, really, one of his slogans was fighting nepotism. Now his brother, his brother-in-law, his sister, his son are all very much.
So maybe he's not quite the puppet that we sometimes like to think he is in the West, ruled by the mullahs.
I don't think he's a puppet. I think he has become increasingly and separate from it. And there are many signs of confrontation between him and some of the mullahs. He's picked an open fight with the legislature, an open fight with the judiciary, both of them who are incidentally run by a couple of brothers who are cronies of Khamenei. So the idea that he is a puppet of Khamenei, I don't think works.
I suppose that idea came up because after the election, Khamenei said, you know, he was elected and gave his imprimatur to Ahmadinejad and so forth.
Yeah. Exactly. And because the first time he was elected, it was clearly Khamenei's decision that put him across as the winner.
We'll go to more of your calls and we'll welcome Youssef. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I'd like to make a comment and maybe get the feedback from your guests. And that would be whether if the Shah prematurely tried to secularize Iran. In the Iranian society, he was completely, in a sense, blind to the Islamic nature or the religious nature of that society. And that kind of like gave the society, even enabled it to uprise against him. And I was just thinking about this when you spoke about Morocco and how Morocco has a monarch and has that kind of, and the monarchy there speaks of a mythical relationship between the monarchy and the people, but the monarch there kept a religious role and always keeps that in
You mean King Hassan? Well, and the same thing with certainly with Saudi Arabia and so many countries. So I think the caller has a good point, doesn't he? I mean, the Shah wanted to secularize and maybe was not as aware as he should have been of the religious fervor of the people.
Well, again, my argument is a little bit different in the book. My argument is that, yes, the Shah wanted to secularize, but he wanted to secularize in his own term. He wouldn't allow any other secular force in Iran to have an independent organizational base. He destroyed the middle, the moderate middle, and the only force, in fact, that he allowed, encouraged, indeed, to grow were the clergy. So on the one hand, he was secularizing, but on the other hand, he was encouraging the clergy to have the kind of a network that allowed them to dominate the democratic movement in 1978. So he had contradictory aspects. And a comparison with Morocco is really very interesting. In Morocco, everywhere you go, or a lot of places where you go, the kind of a slogan you see on walls and things is God, country, king. God, country, and king. In Iran, we had the same three pillars, but it was God, Shah, and country. The country was for the Shah. In Morocco, the Shah, the king, is for the country. That was a very, I think, important distinction between the way the Moroccan system, but I think the Moroccan system is very much in crisis today. All you have to do is read the writings of one of the most brilliant Moroccan members of the royal family, Prince Hisham bin Abdullah, who is very prominent in Morocco and has been writing for several years that Morocco is going to go if it doesn't open up the system.
And speaking of science, where is Reza Pahlavi's son? Is he still in Egypt?
Reza Pahlavi is in the United States, travels between the United States and France. He has an office in Paris and has an office in Washington and travels between the two places.
A listener writes, does Mr. Milani plan to translate his book on the Shah into Farsi as he did with his previous book? That's from Mashoud, one of the listeners.
I am planning to translate it, but I have already been put on that list of banned writers, so I don't think I can publish it in Iran. I might put it on the internet.
Another email writes, as an Iranian-American, I am conflicted by two emotions. I don't like what has happened post-Iranian revolution. I don't like the current system of theocracy. I don't like the fact that they are willing to do anything and everything to stay in power. On the other hand, I also don't like what the U.S. government is doing to Iran. I don't like the sanctions that are beginning to affect the average Iranian in commerce. I don't like assassinating scientists. I don't like covert operations. I believe majority of Iranians would share these sentiments.
I think the part about the covert operations, I don't know whether it has been established that it is the United States. There are allegations that it's the United States. I don't think it has been proven. There are allegations that it might be the Mossad. The regime itself blames Israel for them. So I don't know whether the United States is blamed for that. In terms of the sanctions, I think the United States has tried very hard to bring about the kinds of sanctions that would not hurt the Iranian people, and they have tried to focus these on the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards. They've tried to do that, but I think the caller is right. Because the Revolutionary Guards are now so important part of the economy, you can't go after them without limiting the economy. My sense is that the responsibility for these hardships rests with the corrupt, incompetent, and dishonest regime in Iran that keeps lying to the international community, keeps lying to the IAEA, and begets these kinds of sanctions on people. The people have to remember, Iran could have had a nuclear enrichment site at Bushehr in 1981, Khomeini unilaterally decided to cancel it when it was 75% finished. And then 4 years later, they decided to restart it, but this time they decided to restart it secretly. 30 years later, almost 27 years later, we don't still have Bushehr. Billions of dollars have been spent. Billions of dollars in lost economic opportunity. Whose responsibility it is? It is this regime's responsibility that first unilaterally canceled it and then covertly relaunched it.
Here's a caller on point from Detroit, Michigan. John, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, fascinating topic. I have a question, though, regarding the Shah and his interest in nuclear weapons. How far did he get? And once the Ayatollah took over, did he have an opportunity to glean some of that base knowledge, or did he basically start from scratch again?
The Shah did not get far, except, as I said, he signed one contract with the German company, and that German company finished the Bushehr facility almost 75%. But Iran, the Shah and Iran, had invested heavily in training Iranian scientists. Iran had a $20 million grant, for example, with MIT for the specific purpose of training nuclear physicists. And many of these people went back, and they were part of this infrastructure, scientific infrastructure that the regime tapped into when they decided to relaunch it. But they couldn't reuse Bushehr because they initially abandoned it. And when the war with Iraq came, Saddam Hussein bombed it at least twice. We know for a fact there's some allegations he did it three times. So very little infrastructure was left, but there was knowledge base, these scientists that were used by the regime to relaunch it.
Let me thank the caller. Here's Sean, who writes, terrible as today's Iranian theocracy is, the professor's romanticizing of the Shah's regime and his convenient overlooking of the 1953 CIA overthrow of Iran's democratically elected prime minister in order to install the Shah amounts to historical revisionism.
Well, I don't know whether the caller has read the book. I don't think there is any romanticizing in the book. I have tried to describe the role that the CIA had and the British embassy had and the British intelligence had. But I have not been willing to repeat shibboleths because romantics like this writer have this mythological, simple view of the world. I've tried to go where the evidence led me, and the evidence is a little more complicated than that. But I haven't romanticized it. I honestly believe if you read the book, I don't think you will conclude that I've romanticized them.
Well, speaking about romanticizing, here's my shooter. Says, does Mr. Milani have statistics as to how widespread torture was under the Shah?
We have some statistics. As I said, about 1,500 people were executed in that period. The number of people, there were widespread torture, particularly after the urban guerrilla movement began in Iran. Then the nature of torture became far worse, and the extent of it was far more extensive.
Hardly romanticizing.
Yes.
Here's Mark who writes, Michael, would you ask your guest, has it ever been proven that Ahmadinejad was one of the student leaders responsible for taking the hostages? Do we know much more of his history between then and becoming a leader, specifically regarding his uses of violence and repression? Example, was he in the secret police? He may not have been tall enough to get in the secret police.
I have written an article on Ahmadinejad. It's called Pious Populism. It's available on the internet for free. It was published by Boston Review. My dear friend Josh Cohen published it in Boston Review. Ahmadinejad, we know, participated in the first plenary meeting for taking over the American embassy. The committee that was organizing invited two radical Islamists from every university to a meeting. There they decided they're going to take over the American embassy and take the diplomats hostage. Ahmadinejad says two things. He said, do we have the fatwa from Khomeini? And the student leaders wanted, obviously, plausible deniability. They said, no, we don't have a fatwa yet. And then he said, are we going to take the Soviet embassy? Because in those days, the slogan of the regime was neither East nor West, neither Soviet nor the U.S. They said, no, we're not taking over. So He left the first meeting. Once Khomeini came on board and supported the taking of the hostage, I know after having talked to one of the leaders of the movement, Ahmadinejad tried to come back into the fold, but then they told him he had already left and you cannot be. So he did not come back. We know he was very close to the Quds Brigade, to leaders of the Quds Brigade. This is the group that did some of the most brutal acts of terrorism outside Iran. And in that sense, he was part of the apparatus of oppression. But I've never seen any evidence that he was an actual member of the secret police.
We've got seconds left, and I'm just wondering, I'm not asking you to prognosticate or look in a crystal ball here, but this Green Revolution, more momentum from it, do you think?
I think so. I think the future of Iran is democratic. The path is not easy. It's not going to be easy. This is a very brutal and very dedicated regime. So the short-term path is going to be hard, but
and bloody.
Extremely bloody, absolutely. Yeah. But I am absolutely optimistic that the future of Iran, not the end future destruct, but the future of Iran is democratic. And I think the future of the Middle East is far more democratic than we have ever seen.
Good positive note to end on. Abbas Milani, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure, sir.
The book, The Shah, definitive biography of the Shah of Iran. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Amy Machado, and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Wouldn't be here without you, our listeners, and for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.